You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex here with you. And we've been talking lots of fun murder mysteries this year, lots of comedy murder mysteries. And I'm so delighted to be joined in studio by perhaps who I thought was the least likely candidate to be joining that rank until all of a sudden he published Kill Your Husband. It's Jack Heath. Jack, welcome to Death of the Reader. It's wonderful to have you.
It is amazing to finally be here in the studio where the magic happens.
Oh,
thanks,
my goodness. I know. I love that we bring Elsie and Kiara back from Kill Your Brother. I should have seen it coming. I really should have seen it coming when the books shared the same name, but I opened the first page and I was like, hang on, I know these names. Where do I know these names from? He didn't. No, he didn't. No, did he? Did he? He put his horror novel characters into a fun, whimsical murder mystery with lots of gruesomeness in it? He couldn't. Why'd you do it?
Oh, it could have been even worse, actually, because, oh, gee, that's a bad start to me pitching the book to your listeners, isn't it? Look, my book could have been worse, all right? But I had the plot with the three couples at the remote house with the no phone reception and the partner swap where when the lights come back on, one guy is dead.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, okay, is this going to be a Timothy Blake case or not? And when I decided not, in part because the response to Kill Your Brother had been so warm, I was like, okay, well, I can reuse the same cop from that. I already had a town, but also because Kiara Louie, the detective from Kill Your Brother and now Kill Your Husbands, I treat Kill Your Husbands as a standalone, but yeah, so she was in the previous book and she's a much more realistic sort of detective than Timothy Blake, cannibal FBI consultant / CIA agent. So the police work she does is much more plausible and authentic. And of course, plausible and authentic police work isn't as exciting to read as you might think. So it actually worked perfectly because Kiara, I don't know if you'd call her the main character of this. She probably gets marginally more screen time than anyone else. But the point is the bulk of the book is what happened 2 weeks previously with these three couples up on the hill. And if it was Timothy Blake, the reader would have been like, he's hardly in it. He doesn't get to do any of his palette-based detective work,
yes.
Whereas Kiara, yeah, she does what an actual police officer would do. She talks to witnesses, she compares their statements, she complains about how terrible the forensic pathologist is and all that stuff.
Which was fantastic, by the way. I absolutely loved just that all of those scenes of leading up to like, okay, well, the forensic pathologist is incompetent. What's he screwed up? You'll have to wait and see. I have to wait and see.
You are clearly a very different kind of reader to me, mate. I was having a chat with Benjamin Stevenson the other week, author of the wonderful, wonderful new book, Everyone on This Train is a Suspect.
Yes.
And he was talking about how he's kind of daring and double daring the reader to sort of second guess him. And so he's encouraging almost obliging the reader to play along with the detective. That's not the kind of reader that I am. I am someone who just lets the story wash over me and lets myself enjoy and be surprised by the twists. So it's nice to hear that it sounds like this book I've written, Kill Your Husbands, is working for you, even though you are the second guess the author type of reader. So
Benjamin Stevenson will never admit it, but I'm still convinced that Ernest Cunningham is partially based off me.
Oh, really? Okay. That might be a story you have to talk about off mic. I have to hear about this.
I guess the other interesting thing bringing Kiara and Elise back is that we now have a second cast of characters whose drama dredges back to their athletics days. Was that an intentional choice or is there just gremlins about the athletics world churning at the back of your head?
I know so little about pro athletes and the elite sport in general. When I was writing Kill Your Brother, I realized pretty quickly how little I knew about it. So I had to invite, there's a woman in Canberra, oh man, whose name I'm blanking on. That is so embarrassing because she gave so much into this book, but she was the women's champion for 400 meter hurdles. That was her event at the Commonwealth Games, and she was training for the Olympics and then COVID and then all sorts of stuff. But anyway, so I bought her a cup of coffee and just got her to explain to me all the things I didn't understand about elite sport. So that really played well into kind of Elise's personality in that first book. But in this second one, I already had a thing where I'm like, okay, there's going to be a partner swap. The light lights are going to go out. But the thing is, you can still kind of tell who people are in the dark from their voices. Okay, I won't allow them to speak. And then I'm like, well, you can tell from kind of the smell of your partner. Okay, they're all going to wear the same perfume. And well, they can all have different haircuts. And then I got to kind of like body shape. And I went, okay, if they were all on the same athletics team, then they all could have the same kind of build plausibly. And then I went, how the heck am I going to make the reader believe that Kiara would take her girlfriend to a crime scene on a romantic holiday? And then I was like, oh, well, if she thinks she needs Elise's insight because Elise was in elite sport, these people were in elite sport. It was just a kind of nice
problem solving.
Yeah, yeah. It was just a nice convergence of I always start with these outrageous plot twists and then I work really, really hard to make them convincing.
Yes.
Unless I'm writing children's fiction, in which case I don't bother because kids don't care if something's plausible. They only care if it's awesome. But adults, you know, will throw a book across the room because they go, that would never happen in real life. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the athletic stuff was just me trying to make sure that the reader would buy into this conceit that Kiara would take Elise to an active crime scene.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the other incredible bits of problem solving that you've done, of course, is, as you were mentioning, you know, we have the before and after of this crime. The opening sort of set of chapters is about them uncovering the crime scene, and then we sort of go forwards and backwards from there. And I thought it was so clever you used different names for the same characters in the two timelines, because, of course, the police are being more formal about it, using surnames, and the characters are in the past timeline addressing themselves by their proper names. And I love the way that, as you say, that makes a convincing way to obfuscate a very obvious case of identity. I guess in terms of dealing with that, in terms of trying to make that feel plausible, but also knowing when to show and hide certain things, was that much of a revisions process for you?
Yeah, huge revisions process. So the overall plot didn't change much from the outline that I wrote way, 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 way back. But in terms of things like, so definitely in the first draft, Kiara kept referring to the woman who ran down the mountain, or the man who was found dead in the east bedroom, and stuff like that. And it was just so clunky.
Yeah.
And so then in the second or third or fourth draft, I had a thing where she refers to them as sort of suspect A and victim B. And there was a conceit where in her head, she tried not to think of suspects and, or she tried not to think of victims by their names until they had been formally identified. This was like to avoid slip ups in front of the media and also to avoid making assumptions.
Which she does make, and they're very entertaining.
Yeah, that's right. But that was still pretty clunky. It wasn't until quite late when I'm like, wait, hang on. She could just refer to them by their last names. I've made this so unnecessarily hard for myself. So that's exactly what I did.
But a quintessential thing to happen in a creative space too. Just like
there's an obvious solution. Yeah, yeah. That you miss for months and months because you're over-engineering your story. Yeah, it happens to me all the time. But yeah, it was hard to keep track of. So there's what's actually happening. There's what the reader thinks is happening, and there's what the character thinks is happening. And so keeping track of all those three things, in particular keeping track of how much the reader knows or doesn't, was probably the hardest part of the writing and revision process, and it took a lot of work to get it right. This is why, I mean, at the risk of derailing the whole discussion by bringing up AI, that's one of ChatGPT's biggest weaknesses, right? It can't bear in mind what the reader expects or doesn't because it doesn't, it's just sort of like predictive text. Yeah. So I was very worried about ChatGPT until I was editing this very book. And there's all these comments in the margins from my publisher saying, won't the reader think this? When I'm like, oh yeah, there's no way an AI can do this, or not with the way the technology is designed at the moment. And it's not a matter of a bigger data set or anything to learn from. It's actually quite a different skill.
Yeah. No, I think it's really fun because, especially speaking of things that the readers know, one of the most engaging puzzles to me in this book is the questions of what pressure Elise is under. There's a real sense, I think, that the way you perceive that puzzle is very much going to be down to personal context. Like, you could look at it in the first scene that she is on a mysterious phone call at an ATM and go, yeah, I see what's going on here. Or it could be in the epilogue that you find out. And I love that there's that sort of puzzle as the B plot there.
Yeah. I think it was important for me. So this book gets pretty dark along the way, which won't surprise. Yeah, that won't surprise any of my long-term readers. But it's supposed to be fun dark, not, you know, miserable dark. So that meant that I was going to write this narrative about these three couples whose marriages are always on the rocks for some reason. Actually, let me scroll back. In 2013, that was where the genesis of this book was. Like 50 Shades of Grey was at the top of the charts. And I was like, how do I get some of that action? And so I started kind of plotting out a romance novel about a partner swap. And I never got it working until a couple of years ago when I was like, but if they all killed each other, and then I got the tingles that would show that this was, you know, that was the kind of book I'd want to read. But in the case of, so because these three couples, you know, from the beginning that two of the men are going to end up dead, one of the women is going to end up missing. So it's not a very hopeful story in that sense. So it was really important for me to have Kiara and Elisa's relationship as well, which isn't perfect either, but I didn't want to leave the reader with a sense of, you know, well, all relationships are doomed.
Yes.
Like either you will die having not said the things that you wish you'd said, or you'll get divorced, or one of you will murder the other one or something like that.
Well, all other things aside about the actual content of the writing for Elise and Kiara, anyone who's read Kill Your Brother will be like, well, you know, this is an improvement. No matter what happens, this is an improvement.
Yeah, that book I might have gone a little bit far, which is weird. I was trying to be more, you know, palatable to the mainstream. I said to my publisher, I'm like, okay, how do I reach like the next rung of the author career ladder? How do I get to like Chris Hammer levels? And she's like, you could write something with no cannibals in it, because there's a lot of readers for whom that's a hard nope. And I'm like, okay, I'll write a cheery, feel-good novel about a woman who's trapped in an underground septic tank with her brother who may be a pedophile. And then, so no matter what I try to write, this is always what comes out. I'm just going to have to accept
that. These are the careers writing children's fiction, in case you've forgotten.
I think that's why the adult stuff is so dark. Yeah. Like, every bad thought I ever have needs to get sort of filtered out of the... it's a bit like the children's fiction is the gold, and the adult fiction is the scum that gets like sifted out when you're panning for the gold.
Well, yeah. And I mean, speaking of these other character relationships, one of the things that I absolutely loved in the introduction of this book is when we slowly get each of the perspective chapters from the couples that are up the mountain.
Mm.
And all of them have this same just delicious pacing where you go through their motivations and you're like, this is why they feel tense about this. This is why they feel tense about this. I really liked the first comparison that we got between Oscar and Ilsa, where Oscar presents it as like, you know, the child took my wife's love away from me. And then Ilsa's like, well, he's just painted me as the villain in all of these different ways. Like, you set them all up as sympathetic, and then within the space of a chapter, pull a rug out from under them and make them feel just hollow in a way that almost separates you from the crimes that happened to them.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's not like you don't have sympathy for the characters, but it just felt like the absolute right balance for me in having these characters in this horrible situation and sort of being able to distance yourself from it.
Oh, thank you. I think it's, again, I want my books to be fun. That's my main goal. So as far as if I knew that something, for the plot to work, something terrible had to happen to the character, I was like, okay, so they have to be a bit unlikable so as the reader can enjoy their horrible death.
Yes.
But readers also don't enjoy reading about someone who's entirely unsympathetic either. So I was constantly kind of walking that line. And this led to, again, I didn't plan this. It was just like a really nice unintended consequence, which was that you get kind of the feel of an unreliable narrator, even though each of them, everything they say happened. Yeah. So the reader is getting all the facts. But there's that thing which is particularly, so I've been married like 12 years. And so often my wife and I will go to a party together and we'll participate in the same conversation with another person and then come home and discover that we have completely different interpretations of that conversation. So writing a book about these marriages falling apart was just a really natural fit for that. unreliable narrator thing about how everyone is both more sympathetic and less when you can hear their inner monologue than how they are perceived by the other people. So that was a lot of fun.
And especially when we end each chapter with these like little jabs of internal monologue talking about what they're intending to do, and you reading a mystery novel go, oh goodness, is that the warning sign? Is this the warning sign? Like, it's threat in every direction. It's great.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I read one of the Point Crime books. It was probably from the Scholastic Book Club catalog. It was called Class Trip, and I'm about to spoil the ending, but it was from 1992. So if you haven't read it by now.
Yeah, if you still haven't sent in your Scholastic Book catalog from 1992, you know.
Yeah, it's still in the bottom of your school bag. In your mum and dad's garage. So it was one of those, a bunch of students go on a class trip, they go to an island, they get picked off one by one, and then at the end, and this blew my tiny little mind, the killer was the narrator all along. And I hadn't read any Agatha Christie. I was like, surely no one has ever done this before. It's brilliant. So now I'm a bit older. I know that it has been done before and often quite well. Hopefully it'll be done again. But in this case, I wanted to push that a little bit further and go, okay, what if the killer was the narrator and the reader knew that from the beginning, but they didn't know which one?
Yeah.
So we got all these perspectives, but that seemed like a cool idea. It wasn't until I started writing it that I realized, hang on, that means none of the characters can ever wonder who the killer is, or the reader will be able to eliminate them as a suspect. So that meant that I needed to include a lot more. So I was like, okay, so what are they going to be thinking about? And that kind of led to their personal lives taking a front seat.
That explains the single piece of discomfort I had about that book that I couldn't explain to you until just this second.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Nobody asks, and it really feels so credible because they're all so terrified.
Yeah.
And oh, I love that. I hadn't noticed that until you said it, but that's actually incredibly clever.
I've been listening to the audiobook, and because I can't hold the whole book in my head at once, obviously. So listening to the audiobook, there are still surprises. Like, I know the plot twists, but I don't know the sentence by sentence basis. So as I'm listening to it, I'm going, oh yeah, I remember why I did that. I remember why I did that. And one of the things that I've noticed is that whenever a character is telling the truth, you always get it from a different character's perspective.
Yes.
So as the reader never knows that they are telling the truth, yes. You know, so that was fun too.
That's really good. I love that. Pay attention. Speaking of the audiobook, I was talking with Danuka McKenzie about the audiobook.
Isn't she wonderful?
Danuka McKenzie is wonderful.
She is so gutsy. I pitched a third book called Kill Your Daughter, and my agent was like, don't write that. And I pitched it to the publisher anyway, and she's like, don't write that. No one's going to want to read it. And then I read Taken by Danuka McKenzie, and I'm like, wow, it's similar enough to what I pitched that I was like, she must have really believed in her ability to turn this into an awesome story, and she did it, and I will respect her forever for that.
Oh, absolutely. And she's such a delightful part of the City Crime Fiction community. We're so lucky to have her. But we were talking about the cast of that audiobook, because you've got like a full acting cast playing all of the roles. It is delightful and detailed and so well performed. Talk to me a little bit about having your books put to audio like that. Do you have to write differently for that sort of medium?
It's interesting. So yes, I mean, often just on a purely basic technical level, you have to remind the listener who's talking more often, more sort of Cole said this, Dom said that, as opposed to just he or no dialogue tags at all.
You couldn't do a Ben Hobson's Death of John Lacey and not ever explain anything about who is talking.
Yeah, exactly. Would not work. But you also end up with, it's a bit like working with an illustrator in a sense, because you write a book and you know what everything looks like in your head, but you never find out what it looked like in the reader's head until suddenly you have a book that's illustrated or adapted for film. And then you're like, oh, okay, this is someone else's vision of my words. An audiobook is a little bit like that. So every actor kind of put their own spin on the characters. And it's not a radio play, for the record. That wouldn't have worked because, again, the first name, last name thing, you couldn't have the casting would reveal who was who. So instead, all these actors have got to play all one another's characters as well. But luckily, they're all like the Sydney acting community and they all know one another. They're all friends. So, you know, so it was really cool to see the way that they made some of these characters like Oscar sounds a little bit more kind of haggard than I pictured in when I was writing it.
But that also works really well because everyone else pictures him as really haggard.
Yeah, right? Exactly. No, it was cast perfectly. One of the things that I've learned about my job over the years is kind of the more I'm willing to hand my work over to other people and not interfere with their work.
Yeah.
So whether that's a reader or a publisher or a producer of an audiobook or a film or whatever, the better the results tend to be. So
yeah, I remember you posted a chart to one of your socials accounts a while ago of like how much effort you put into the book over time and how much you get out of it. And there's like the steep cliff and then it just starts to slowly get worse.
Yeah. And I'm still working on it long after it makes financial sense to still be working on it. Yeah.
So I think that sort of like letting go of it is definitely sort of part of what that's about, where having those insights and making those big gains to sort of understand how the text is going to work in different contexts.
Yeah. I've learned almost the hardest part is not overthinking it as I go. It's like trying to get into a flow state where every time it occurs to me to put something in, I do, because it can always be taken out later if it doesn't work. And when I'm editing, any time it occurs to me to make a change, I do it. And sure, a lot of those changes are likely to make it worse rather than better. But as long as I have better judgment than a coin toss, then in the aggregate, those thousands and thousands of tiny decisions will lead to a book that's pretty good. So I just need to make sure that when I'm writing, I'm not thinking about the book as a whole and going, oh my God, this isn't going to work. And maybe I don't have what it takes to be a writer, or maybe I did have it before and I don't have it anymore, or something's happened. And instead, just look at the page in front of me and go, okay, what can I do with this page? Yeah. This will make it a tiny bit better. That will make it a tiny bit better. And then just kind of disappear into the individual brushstrokes.
I guess one of the other things in terms of the reader experience is I feel like readers, especially in crime fiction, have this strange thing where we're okay with guts, gore, violence, explosions, all of these terrible things. But as soon as someone mentions sex, it's like, I'm out. Too much. That's whoa, step back. How did you feel about integrating, like, you know, obviously the partner swapping is like part of the pitch that you had for this book?
Yeah.
How did you feel about transitioning from Timothy Blake, horrible, weird, gruesome world into something like this, where it still has that signature Jack Heath horror-ish novel vibe, but has this extra complicating layer that could throw readers off?
Yeah, I don't know. I heard one of my favorite critics, a guy named Glenn Weldon in New York, was talking about a particular TV show, and he was talking about the difference between how British and American authors see sex. And he was saying that in the UK, sex is naughty. In America, sex is dirty. And there was this sort of interesting kind of ways that it is walled off in the culture. And I found myself thinking, what's it like in Australia? And it occurred to me that I actually don't know.
Yeah, right.
I don't know my own culture well enough, maybe because I'm in it. There's that sort of what is water problem for the fish. But I did know that in this case, so I'm 37 now. These characters are all in their early 30s. And I do feel like maybe, hopefully even, I'm part of the last generation of men that is incapable of communicating. You know, so the thing is, if you want to do something like a partner swap, which I've never done for the record, but, you know, any kind of kink or even just sort of regular sex, like communication is super important. But men of my generation and up were not taught to communicate. Yeah. That's not how, possibly the reason that I even am a writer is because I'm not capable of expressing my feelings very well in a conversation, but I can do it through the medium of fiction, kind of. And so I felt like, yeah, I don't know whether readers will react badly to the sex or not, but I do feel like I have enough to say about it.
Yeah.
And that this might be my last chance to say it before the culture becomes hopefully so accepting that it's not even an issue. Certainly these characters, I mean, everything would have been fine if they'd just been open with one another about what they wanted and what they were feeling and stuff like that. And but because they are part of my generation, they're sort of emotionally stunted.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, that's definitely like sort of the most horror novel thing to me about this is that constant feeling of just like, oh my God, just say what you're thinking. Just say it. please, for the love of God.
Yeah.
Like that horror movie trope of if you just didn't open that door, we'd all be fine.
But you'd say it's also a trope of romance novels, exactly. Right? Like there's often in romance novels dual perspectives, and towards the end, by the time the reader knows that they love one another, there has to be some kind of wacky misunderstanding that could be solved if someone wasn't too proud and just said what they were thinking. Yeah.
I've just had the horrifying realization, and I don't know what this says about me, that maybe I see romance and horror fiction the same in my brain. I'll have to reflect on that.
Well, I mostly read rom-coms. That's like my happy place is reading, because I don't like reading the kind of stuff I write because it feels like work. Yeah. So even when it's a really, really, really good book in the genre I write, I'm always thinking, ooh, that was clever. Yes. Oh, I wonder why she did that. Yeah, exactly. Whereas when it's rom-coms, they're like, I have no idea how to write this, so I can just kind of absorb myself into the characters and the story.
I think it's also super interesting too, because talking about that reception to concepts that you don't necessarily know, one of my favorite things to do for interviews is to go find negative reviews on a book. Go, what did they miss and how can I turn that into a question?
Oh boy. Okay, what do you got for me?
Nobody I could find had written a negative review for this book that was insulting anything but your hair.
Yeah, that's right.
How did you manage that?
Well, it's possible, to be fair to those reviewers and commenters, it's possible that my hair is so bad that it just distracted them from things that might have upset them in the work had they not been distracted by the hair. But I do think it helped to have such a diverse range of people working on this book. It's so misleading that it's just my name on the cover, because there were so many people involved. I had two publishers, so Audible and Allen & Unwin. So that means two copy editors, two structural editors, two proofreaders, plus there's the effort of, you know, all the actors and the sales team and the cover designers and stuff. So there's all these people working so passionately on just trying to find something that readers will enjoy. And I don't think necessarily you need to make a work of art that is appreciated by everyone. I think sometimes getting a few people who love something is maybe better than getting a lot of people who merely like it. But in this case, we seem to have struck gold with finding a story that everyone seems to see just a little bit of themselves in, but also kind of be able to be a bit horrified by, but also laughing. So I don't know if I'll ever hit gold like this again. I'm more proud of this than anything else I've ever written.
That's really fantastic. I suppose, are you the sort of author who checks Goodreads regularly?
Yeah. Okay. I find that, so the 5-star reviews are kind of good for boosting my ego, but to be honest, I've had enough bad reviews over the years that I no longer take them very personally. And in fact, if you're on Goodreads enough, you go, okay, well, I wrote this book and it had a bunch of 5-star reviews and it had a bunch of 1-star reviews. So therefore, you walk away with the conclusion that, you also walk away with the conclusion that it's just a matter of taste, right? So either the book was for them or it wasn't. It doesn't say much about me and it doesn't say much about the book, to be honest. But nevertheless, so the 1-star reviews, it's like, well, that person was probably never going to like it anyway. And the 5-star reviews, well, are good for my ego. But again, there's been a lot of them so that I'm kind of desensitized to it. It's those 2-to-4-star reviews of people who wanted to like the book or expected to like the book, but it fell short of their expectations in some way. I do enjoy reading those, and sometimes, so I mean, it's hard to do the work of writing when you feel like people are watching over your shoulder. Yeah. So I try not to disappear into it too vividly. But whenever someone highlights something they think I've done wrong, often that changes the way I write the next book. There was, for example, an early review of Hangman, which was mostly positive, but said that in the end, the book commits the cardinal sin of having the detective solve the case pretty much by accident. And I was like, oh yeah, he kind of did. For all his brilliance, like he didn't really use it in the conclusion. So in the second book, when Timothy Blake gets paired up with his partner again, he's pretty pleased of being asked by the FBI. And his partner, Agent Thistle, is like, you solved our last case by accidentally bumbling into the killer's house. I don't actually need your help. And everyone would know that if we hadn't both signed NDAs.
Yes.
So that reviewer's criticism became a really interesting point of contention between these two characters. Yeah. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if I wasn't reading the reviews. No. So I do. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of my favorite things to do is to read reviews of my favorite books and sit there and laugh at people who didn't get things, but also like sort of develop a different appreciation for like, oh, that's actually a really interesting point.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying is, Jack, I really look forward to the people who do leave negative reviews on this book, because I'm going to have a great time sitting there and thinking or laughing at them, or both.
Indeed. Well, as long as their wives don't murder them, I'll be happy. I don't want any dead husbands on my account.
Even though the internet seems to think you do? I don't know what's with
that. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of people who seem to think this is a work of nonfiction. I'm sure if they picked it up and read it, then they would pretty quickly work out.
Surely it's people making the wrong Google search for the how to kill your husband book, right? Surely.
Yeah, probably. I should talk to Kathy Lett and see if she had the same problem. She wrote a book literally called How to Kill Your Husband like 10, 20 years ago. I'll see if she got any flack.
Either way, you're listening to Death of the Reader. Jack Heath, massive thank you for joining us here on the show. It's been wonderful reading this book, and I can't wait to get to the end of it. It's not often I don't get the chance to finish a book before one of these, and I'm very excited.
Oh, do let me know what you think. I can't wait to hear.